recently we had a guest stop by the Earth Eats Studios in Bloomington, Indiana. Gary Paul Nabhan is the author of a number of books, including Where Our Food Comes From. And he's also been called the father of the local food movement.
And I'm a bioterroirist. I live in Arizona, but I'm a Hoosier refugee.
He spoke as part of the Bloomington Eats Green Conference. He signed some of his new books, and he got me really, really excited about apples. But first things first, I wanted to know what the father of the local food movement has in his fridge.
What is in my fridge right now is some of our own lamb and turkey, a bunch of grape leaves and prickly pear that I harvested last summer, and a few roadkills. I was chastised by Barbara Kingsolver for trying to promote local foods nationally by getting people involved in roadkills, and she said it won't work. That's why I have to write a best-selling book to follow yours, because you're not going to do it that way.
Well, you're also, in addition to being a terroirist, you're an ethnobotanist. What's an ethnobotanist?
An ethnobotanist is someone who looks at the cultural traditions of food and medicines among the diverse communities of any particular place. Mm-hmm. And so we go around the world eating our way through different cultural traditions. It's a wonderful way to spend a career.
I was going to say, that sounds like a great job.
Yeah.
Wow. You've been called the father of the local food movement.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty big responsibility.
And as my wife said, who's the mother?
Right, exactly. How'd you get that title?
I don't know. It came from being in a Time magazine cover story about local versus organic, and then Mother Earth News then said I was father of the local food movement, and then I went to Carleton College to accept an honorary PhD, and I said, why am I getting this? And they said, because you're the father of the local food movement. And I said, I am? You know, so it's – you wonder how these things creep up on you, you know.
Is it a lot of pressure to live up to that?
Well, I would give credit to the grandparents of the local food movement, Joan Gasow and Wendell Berry and people like that, rather than trying to figure out the parentage. The grandparentage is a lot more interesting to
me. Well, let's start off with some definitions.
Okay.
Tell me, what is a GMO, genetically modified organism?
A GMO is an organism that has been developed by scientists in a laboratory using what are called transgenic technologies, where we're literally taking the inheritance of one species of organism and transferring it, whether it's disease resistance or a nutritional characteristic or a biochemical pathway, and putting that into another kind of organism. And both farmers and plant breeders and animal breeders have been doing genetic manipulations for thousands of years, but it's the intensity of this technology and how much it costs and how much control companies want from that that have become the moral and political issues. And of course, there are definitely moral issues about moving genes from sheep into people or cloning sheep or something like that. So it's sort of like the technology has gotten ahead of the moral and ethical discussions of how these impact the world.
Mm-hmm. Then what is a monoculture?
A monoculture is a single crop, or in some cases a single genetic clone, being grown over hundreds, if not thousands or tens of thousands of acres. So it's a genetically uniform food-producing plant or animal that has very little natural variety left in it.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment. To you, what is slow food?
Slow food is a nickname for a broad, diffuse movement that is encouraging us to look for alternatives to fast food, first of all, and secondly, to support the producers and purveyors of food that is produced in safe, clean, and fair ways.
And then to you, since you are the father of the local food movement, what is local eating?
Local eating is paying attention to sourcing our foods from the nearest place from which we can obtain a particular food. And the definition of local depends on the environment that you're in. So people in Portland, Oregon can access fish, livestock, fruits, and vegetables from a radius of 40 miles around their home, where those of us in the desert might want to define local as a 250-mile radius.
That's right. And you eat – you try to eat now 220 miles, I believe, is what the dust jacket said.
That's right.
How difficult is that, or how easy is it?
There's a lot of variability in productivity from year to year in the desert. So I can personally do that fairly comfortably, but I'm more interested in what a community can do than an individual. All of us, if we spend enough crazy energy, can probably source most of our food from more narrow proximity than that. But if we're trying to help a community transition to a less carbon-consumptive food economy, then looking more broadly at these issues is sometimes necessary.
Yeah. And another, our last definition, heirloom seeds.
Heirloom seeds are particular adapted stocks of seeds that have been passed hand to hand by people in the same place over many generations. They may be native seeds or immigrant seeds that have come into a particular locality, but then they have multiple generations of being passed through family members or through community members rather than being purchased from a seed company or some kind of clearinghouse.
Tell me why they're important. Why should people use them in their gardens?
There's more genetic diversity left in these seeds, and often they were selected for flavor, texture, and keeping qualities that we don't see in a lot of modern cultivars of vegetables. But they also are adapted to place in a way that reduces the amount of pampering, including water and energy, that would be needed to grow them if they were grown out of place.
Mm. And let's talk now about apples. People love apples.
I love apples.
I know. We're in sort of an apple area, I guess. We have a lot of orchards. People like to go pick apples. And we know, like, Granny Smith, Red Delicious. I think the apples that people generally eat and buy from the grocery stores, you know, maybe a dozen, half dozen. There's so much more to apples than that, though.
At one time, Americans had access to 16,000 different varieties of apples, sour ones and sweet ones, red ones and yellow ones, tear-shaped ones and lumpy ones, ones that were good for making cider, others for pies, others for fritters, others for pancakes and sauces. Now 90% of the apples eaten in North America are from just 12 varieties, and most kids can only name two or three different apples, if that. And so a Red Delicious becomes all that a child thinks an apple can be. And it would be like thinking that all dogs are like Lassie and not knowing that dogs range from Chihuahuas to St. Bernards, except in this case we're missing out on incredible flavors and textures. 91% of the 3,500 apples that we have left in nursery commerce in the United States are threatened and endangered. They're being offered by just a couple nurseries, and the average age of a nurseryman is older than the average age of a farmer. So we're at risk of losing many of the 3,500 apples that we have left on this continent unless we do something about it soon. And through the Renewing America's Food Traditions Alliance, we're training hundreds if not thousands of more people to go out and collect cuttings from apple trees called scion wood, learn how to graft them and grow those apples out in abandoned orchards. Southern Indiana and southern Illinois, because of a character known as Johnny Appleseed, are in the seed shadow of one of the great areas of apple diversity on the North American continent. Johnny Appleseed propagated apples by seed rather than by cuttings, and so great range of varieties emerged out of these pippins or seedling apples. And so right where we are today is one of the most diverse areas in North America for apples. You have some orchards near here that have 700 varieties, which is astonishing. And you have one of the top 10 farmers markets in the country that has many great heirloom varieties. Farmers market like the Bloomington one probably has 60 to 80 apple varieties in comparison to most grocery stores that have 5 to 10.
You're an apple lover, so what's your favorite apple to eat raw right off the tree?
I love something called the candle sinap, which is a crisp, pale, fleshed apple that's sort of teardrop shape. It's from Crimea in Russia and Turkey originally, but has been grown in the U.S. for over a century. And it's just unlike any apple I've ever seen. It looks like this translucent globe of light hanging from a tree, like candles were put in a tree. It's a pale yellow skin. And it just has a crispness and freshness and kind of vanilla and cinnamon aftertastes that are just stunning.
Well, vanilla and cinnamon aftertaste, that I would put that in a pie, sounds like. What's a good apple for pie?
Well, it depends where you make the pie. In the South, people tend to like tart apples for pies, and in the North, they like sweets, and vice versa for their fresh eating apples. So it's from what kind of pie tradition that you've emerged. If you like tart apples, some in the range of the Granny Smiths, I'm not promoting Granny Smiths alone, but that have that kind of nice tartness or bite to them is nice. But, you know, there's apples like Magnum Bonum and Gloria Mundi that are old apple varieties that make terrific pies. And I like a lot of the Witter Pear Mains for pies, good keeping apples that then you can use a month or two after they've been picked and still have great apple pies. It used to be that apples were celebrated for being good keepers. That was the vernacular phrase for an apple that could last a long time in storage and still taste great. And I think we ought to promote the notion of good keepers as something that we want in our community, again, whether they're people or apples.
I like it. Well, hearing you talk about all these varieties of apples, I'm intrigued. I'm not sure I've had any of those apples that you're talking about. How did we get here? How did we get to the point where I go to the supermarket and I can only buy 4 or 5 different varieties?
Well, it's a stepwise reduction in apples that have happened over about 120 years. From the first mail order apple catalogs with the beautiful color pictures that said, grow red delicious and you can put your kid through college or something like that. And apple salesmen were some of the first traveling salesmen in the U.S. once the railroads went through. And so the thrill of having a color catalog show up with your door and then 2 weeks later an apple salesman was a great thrill for rural people. And so places like the Stark Brothers Nurseries captured the American imagination with their promotion of apples. It was much like P.T. Barnum promoting circuses. And temporarily wowed people, and the next thing we knew, about 100 apples were dominating trade rather than several thousand. Then the industrialization of apple production meant that people were looking for uniform apples that could be mechanically harvested and shipped in frozen boxes. So apples that had different keeping qualities from the norm that the business was looking for affected it. And then we lost tons of apples during Prohibition because most Americans were still drinking hard cider more than beer or wine up until that time. And hard cider became one of the targets of Prohibition. And by the time Prohibition was repealed, a lot of the knowledge about how to make hard cider from heirloom apple blends went out. Fortunately, we're seeing a revival in both hard and sweet ciders of heirloom apple blends.
Let's talk now about your career. You're a lecturer. You travel all over speaking to groups like you did Friday. You've written all these books. You teach at the University of Arizona. It feels like you're preaching to the choir a little bit. The group that was in the auditorium on Friday, co-op buyers, people who try to eat locally, live sustainably. How do you get your message out to people who eat at McDonald's all the time, who don't go to co-ops?
Well, the interesting thing is that doing conservation work through food communities rather than doing conservation work through, say, the Sierra Club or World Wildlife Fund has put me into contact with people of far more walks of life, income levels, and ethnic backgrounds than any of my previous conservation work working for nonprofits and universities. That's because everyone at some level deeply cares about their food and has food memories from a more diverse time in America. So there's sort of a personal, visceral, sensory appeal to this because we all have food memories of an heirloom tomato or a delicious lime or lemon or orange or pomegranate or strawberry that we can't find anymore. And what I find is that the food activism crosses cultures more easily than other kinds of environmental issues. That I'm talking to Republican conservative ranchers one day in a small town in Idaho or Texas. The next day, I'm talking to urban permaculturalists living in multi-ethnic neighborhoods in Chicago or New Orleans. And to me, that's pretty amazing that people across all colors and walks of life are concerned about our food system and want something healthier not only for themselves but for their children and for their parents.
You got a great question on Friday from someone in the audience, an excuse that I know I personally hear often for not eating locally. It's expensive to go to the co-op and to go to the farmer's market. Talk to those people.
Local food restaurants that are paying farmers and orchard keepers what they're worth tend to have higher price points than a Red Lobster or a steakhouse. But at the same time, the average price in farmers' markets is often lower than the same commodity in grocery store chain stores. The same apple, however, may be higher in a Whole Foods or a health food store where there's a lot of middlemen involved. So one part of the local food movement is to reduce the number of middlemen because today, farmers get 4 to 15% of every consumer dollar if they're putting their food into the commodity market. 100 years ago, they were getting 60% of every consumer dollar. The rest of that money is going to the middlemen. So if farmers are offering their food directly to you at a farmer's market, they have some extra costs that they have to cover in terms of the gas and getting there rather than letting a truck pick up their produce at the farm. But typically those foods are coming in lower in my surveys than what we might see at a grocery store chain or certainly something like Whole Foods. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a lot of scrutiny that we have to look at the cost of very nutritious, healthy, fresh food relative to what we're getting through some of the commoditized markets. And we have to ask ourselves whether it really is more expensive to eat well or not.
Expense aside, what do you suppose is the biggest misconception of local eating?
I think there are two misconceptions. The simplistic view is that it's always less costly and less carbon costly to get something from closer to your house than it is something from 500 miles away. In some cases, because small pickup trucks do use more gas than a big diesel truck full of produce, the price per unit weight is higher with a food coming, say, from a farm 40 or 50 miles away than it is a larger size farm of food coming from 500 miles away. But we have the capacity with local food to change some of those variables easier. We can collaborate with four or five nearby farmers and take turns bringing all of our produce into a market in a slightly larger biodiesel truck. We can go back from town with our truck full, which typically doesn't happen with some of the national food distribution services. We can also work on how much energy goes into the food on the farm and reduce that rather than just thinking about the transportation issue as a separate issue. So the big misconception is that local necessarily means closest to where I'm picking it up. It may be that there's efficiencies in having a route through different habitats over a 150-mile range that brings a variety of foods because each of those farms are at a different point in the season, and that our greatest efficiencies are building relationships across zones closer to home, but not thinking that mileage is the only metric that we should be looking at.
One of the goals of our show is to get people to feel more connected to their food and where it's coming from. You've been doing this your whole life. How have you felt a change knowing where your food has come from, knowing that it's come closer to where you live? Talk about the human aspect of that.
First of all, I feel this incredible rapport with the people who grow the part of food I eat that I don't grow. So that my neighbors who I buy beef from, I raise lamb and periodically turkeys, are now friends and we swap foods. We have an exchange network and I know the struggles they're going through. So the food has a human face and I know the place that it's from. Second of all, I feel that I'm made from the very molecules of the place that I live in, from the soil that I live in, because so much of my food is from my place. So I don't feel displaced anymore. I feel connected to the community and the land in a way that I carry with me spiritually, emotionally, and viscerally. And I think that grounds my life and makes me feel less lost in a rapidly changing world.
We had a listener write in with a question. Our executive producer, Adam Schweigert, asked it here off microphone. Compare a conventional tomato that's locally grown with an heirloom tomato that's been flown in. What kind of trade-off should we accept in this interim period as we're advocating for more locally grown heirloom organic produce?
So what we're talking about here is that we tend to have a human propensity for pitting one kind of label of something we value against another and seeing them as either-or choices. For instance, most of the local produce in the farmers market that I helped jumpstart up near the Grand Canyon in northern Arizona was not certified organic, but it was local, of course. And none of it could be officially labeled organic. But when we talked to the farmers, regardless of them having that official legal label, almost all of them were using organic practices. And so the it's a false choice to think it's either local or organic there. On the other hand, I've stopped eating strawberries, or including organic strawberries, from Chile in the winter, and I've resolved myself to just eating strawberries in season that are grown closer to home because I don't quite see the value of bringing in organic strawberries from 5,000 miles away. So I think the key thing is that as we're making these transitions, to have some flexibility and get deeper than the labels, what I say, deepen our sense of local, that we can get trapped if we take these things as categorical entities that, for instance, is food really local in Arizona if it's using groundwater that's transferred from a river 250 miles away or from water from a well 500 feet deep? We could claim that the food is local, but it's using extra local water and fossil fuel. So we need to get beyond the simple labels and look at what's sustainable both to the land and water and perhaps the cultures that are the best stewards of the land, and move towards sort of a more holistic, improvisational way of making these choices. I think the interesting thing about buying from the farmers market is that there's some kind of traceability and means to obtain more information about it. So if I see a guy selling pork and 2 weeks later I happen to drive by his farm and there's a lot of erosion going on and I see his farm sign, I say, oh boy, that is local pork, but now I have an indicator that he may not be as good of a land steward as I had presumed. Who are the other pork salesmen at the market and can I see their farming practices? So to some extent, it's about relationship building, that if we want to go back to that pork producer and say, boy, I'd feel a lot more comfortable with buying your pork if you have some perennial forages rather than a dry lot with open mud there. I'd really help promote your products to my neighbors if you could improve your practices. And then I hear, I've always wanted to do that, but I've never had the incentive for it. We built a relationship that's positively reinforcing. He's challenging the way I eat, and I'm challenging the way he farms in a positive way.
Gary Paul Nabhan, the father of the local food movement, bioterroirist, professor, lecturer, and author. He stopped by the Earth Eats studios in January of 2010. Stop by the Earth Eats website for recipes, foodie news, and more interviews with farmers and local food gurus. We're online at eartheats.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.